Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We'll start off with cat videos, then we'll talk about shrimp and oysters for a while, and then segue seamlessly into a discussion of Hollywood journalism. No, there is no connection between those three. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 9th of April. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And do me a favor and forget macroeconomics for a minute. The Greek debt crisis and what the Fed may or may not do about interest rates. Forget about all that. Let's talk about what's really important. Cat videos on YouTube. They're great, right? Well, they are, but they don't make any money, which is why YouTube is going to start offering a video service with no ads, but with, however, a monthly fee. The company has sent notices to its content creators saying as much. Those creators get money from the ads that YouTube runs with their stuff, which is how that works. No word on the timing of this thing or how much that fee might be. And it is worth a mention here that Netflix has enjoyed some big success in getting people to pay for streaming video. But will customers pay good money for cat videos? Marketplace's Dan Weissman starts us off.
Getting users to pay for ad-free cat videos seems, in one sense, worth a shot. Brian Weiser is an analyst with Pivotal Research.
If you could sell content that costs you nothing and charge a very premium price for that inventory, it's worth trying, isn't it?
He does think it's a long shot. Asked whether people hate ads enough to pay a fee to skip them, Weiser calls the idea silly. And yes, lots of people pay for Netflix, but he doesn't think YouTube is real competition.
House of Cards will be meeting people building houses with cards.
Count Hank Green among those who think it's worth a shot. He earns his living making YouTube videos. His channels include Vlogbrothers with his brother John. Another, Crash Course, features education videos, astronomy, biology, history. He says he's got 33 employees, and he hates advertisements.
I much prefer the paid models to advertising models. I don't like advertising models. I think they're inefficient. And I like hate seeing advertisements that are like blatantly manipulative and even deceptive on my content.
What's been working for him recently is asking viewers for support directly. Not everybody has to give, just enough.
So really, it's not about creating content that everybody's going to watch. It's about creating content where somebody says after they watch it, you know what, I'd feel better if I paid for that.
It sounds suspiciously like public radio. Coda. He writes me back later with a comeback to that House of Cards swipe. He says, if you're one of the 5,000 super diehard card stackers in the world, maybe videos of people building houses of cards is more valuable to you than House of Cards. Okay. I'm Dan Weissman from Marketplace.
The new water restrictions out here in California aren't just limited to actual water. Cutbacks are also coming to bathrooms and kitchens across the state, where new standards for appliances, think low-flow toilets and faucets here, could save around 10 billion gallons of water the first year. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports that because of its size, California does have a history of pulling industry toward conservation.
The new standards go into effect for toilets and urinals, but also for kitchen and bath faucets sold after January 1st. When California rolled out stricter fuel and emissions regulations for cars, the auto industry eventually adopted the guidelines for all cars. Now many are saying the same could hold true for toilets and faucets.
The adage is, where California goes, so goes the market.
Andy Hoffman is a professor at the Erb Institute at the University of Michigan, which focuses on sustainability in business. Converting a standard faucet into low flow isn't as complicated as re-engineering a car, but Hoffman says companies could have an incentive to market the more efficient products.
It could also get them to bring down the cost because they're going to increase sales. Certainly, California is going to be a motivated market to buy perhaps waterless urinals or dual flush toilets.
Hoffman says people who don't like low-flow faucets might be tempted to buy online, but state incentives could keep that to a minimum. Others say consumers are already used to efficient products and won't go out of their way to buy older ones. Tracy Quinn is a water policy analyst with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
I don't think that most consumers out there will notice a difference between a toilet that flushes with 1.6 gallons or one that flushes with 1.28.
Quinn notes that even in states that aren't racked by drought, saving drinking water that now goes down the drain or toilet still makes financial sense and is something she thinks consumers will want. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was a V-shaped day. High at the open, low at lunchtime, then strong on the upside into the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're coming up in just a couple of weeks, in fact, on the fifth anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon disaster, the explosion and sinking of that oil rig that killed 11 people and poured oil into the Gulf of Mexico for 87 days. That spill cost the companies involved billions of dollars, money that went in part to compensate the local businesses harmed by all the oil. Local businesses like fishermen bringing in Gulf shrimp and oysters. The fishing industry worked hard to win back its customers after the spill, and they have succeeded almost too well. From WWNO in New Orleans, Lane Kaplan-Levinson reports.
You think a seafood dock smells bad? Try walking into the New Orleans Fish House. More than a dozen workers in white aprons and knee-high rubber boots feverishly sharpen knives to clean puppy drum and hand-cut tuna steaks.
We supply almost every restaurant in the city. We supply Acme Oyster House. We supply Commander's Palace. We supply Emeralds, all the Brennan's restaurants. We're running 300 and 500 deliveries a day.
Michael Ketchum is director for national retail sales at the Fish House. He convinces grocery stores and restaurants that Gulf seafood is the way to go. He says the reputation is back with the help of QR codes. You know, those square-shaped barcodes that look like staticky TV screens.
On the back of each bag of product is this QR code. It's right here by our UPC code, and a shopper can scan this code with their smartphone, and it will pull up a map where this product was harvested from.
The more you know exactly where something comes from, Ketchum says, the more you trust it.
If you look at where the oil spill was and look at the questions people had, you knew that there was a disconnect between what products were caught where. I had someone ask me if crawfish was affected by the oil spill. They asked me if catfish was affected by the oil spill. Those two items aren't even harvested in the Gulf.
They're freshwater species. So people trust the seafood again, but now there's a new problem, supply. Restaurants can change menus when an order falls through, but for big box clients like Target and Costco, that doesn't fly.
You know, I mean, when you're talking a nice retail chain, you're not talking about 200 or 300 pounds of product. You know, you're talking about a couple hundred thousand pounds of product. They want to know if they plan it out and run ads that it's going to be there.
Part of the seafood industry's full-time job is to say, hey, it's going to be there.
Be sure you're buying certified Louisiana seafood, certified that it's from the rich Gulf waters that give our seafood outstanding flavor and guaranteed it was caught by a Louisiana fisherman.
Ads made by the Louisiana Seafood and Marketing Board brand Gulf seafood as a specialty product. The hope is that an authentic Louisiana label will get fishermen a better price. Tony Gutierrez is sorting crabs on his dock in Hopedale, Louisiana, about an hour outside New Orleans. He's not happy with the day's catch.
You see what we had this morning? That was literally about $220 worth of crabs. And you had $100 worth of bait and $100 worth of fuel to get here, so it doesn't add up.
Crabs seemed fine right after the spill, but for the past few years, Gutierrez is pulling up empty traps. He says the dispersants used to sink the oil to the bottom of the Gulf destroyed the beds where crabs lay eggs. Now, fewer areas to catch crabs means more competition.
Yeah, everybody's being shoved between Hopedale Bayou all the way to Point Lash. It's putting too many fishermen in one spot.
There's the irony. After the spill, people needed convincing to eat the available seafood. Now consumers want it, and it's hard to find. That's why Tony's struggling to meet the demand. Over in New Orleans' French Quarter, the 135-year-old P&J Oyster Company is having the same problem, owner Al Sinceri.
They're saying basically that the oyster landings are the same as what they were pre-oil spill, And there's no way, if it was, we would not have a 300% increase at the dock on the price of oysters.
For the first time in its century-old existence, P&J has lost a lot of customers.
We did fine after World War I, during World War I, during World War II, during the Depression, during all the recessions, during all the environmental issues, until this happened.
Back at wholesaler New Orleans Fish House, Michael Ketchum also worries about long-term supply.
I may be trying to build a career here and it may go away. Who knows? I'm banking 2015 sales on product that's not even born yet, not even harvested. I know historically it's been there, but now we've done something to the environment.
5 years after the spill, Gulf seafood's probably safe to eat, if you can find it. In New Orleans, I'm Lane Kaplan-Levenson for Marketplace.
The reviews for the Apple Watch have been a little, you know, meh, to be honest, so far. One of the big complaints being, as we knew it would be, battery life. And that is not just an Apple problem either. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. We have brought him on to explain why we still don't have a mobile battery that we can love. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
I would like to talk, my friend, about batteries today, please.
Yes, sir. Let's talk device batteries,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
I recently went to Austin, Texas, as you know, and I talked to this guy, Astro Teller. He's the head.
Is that really his name? Astro Teller?
That is, I believe okay. It was changed, the first name. But Astro anyway. Teller, he has this ridiculous title. It is, I think, Captain of Moonshots at Google
For
X.
Google, okay.
They deal with these like really big ideas. And I asked him, so what's the big thing that you really wish you had that you don't have? And this is what he said.
Okay.
It comes up over and over and over again that a 10 times increase in the weight-oriented density of batteries would enable so many other moonshots if we can find a great idea. We just haven't found one yet.
Weight-oriented density of batteries. So more oomph for what you can get in that tiny little thing, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So here is the 11th bajillion dollar question. Why haven't we found one yet?
The answer is that unlike the thing that has made possible all these devices that we use, really, really powerful, amazing screens, mm-hmm. amazing computing in our pockets, that has all been made possible by Moore's Law,
right.
which I'm sure you're familiar
yep.
with. These leaps and bounds forward in computing technology becoming smaller and smaller and smaller. There is no Moore's Law for batteries. That's partly because we're playing with chemistry. We're not playing with computing technology. And I talked to another guy recently who thinks a lot about this. His name is Matthew Norden, and he's at MNL Partners. And he described the different process of actually trying to make a better battery for our devices.
Okay.
That's more dark art. You know, it's not quite a, you know, witch around a cauldron, but it's close.
It's very Harry Potter-ish.
Or Macbeth. Yeah. Someone's got to die, right? So this is a really problematic thing. Kai, I brought you something. I made you something.
Do you have an Apple Watch? No, I don't.
This is sadly not an Apple Watch. This is the size approximately of a battery that would power your phone for a week.
Okay, so this is, it's a stack of cardboard torn up into 2x2-inch squares stacked 1.5 inches high.
Yeah. You don't want that in your pocket,
right? I don't
want this
in my pocket.
Or on your wrist.
Right.
And this is a problem. This is, by the way, a problem that has been coming up with the Apple Watch reviews.
Right.
Apple Watches really only last for like a day, right? I do have some good news, though.
Okay.
This week—
You do have an Apple Watch for me? No?
I do not, sadly.
Right.
But this week, some news came out of Stanford. They built a smartphone battery. It doesn't last super long, but it charges in under a minute.
Wow, that's some dark art.
That is some dark art. And it's made out of aluminum, which is different from the lithium-ion batteries that we all use now.
Right.
And the important characteristics, I think, that we're all looking for in these batteries that power wearable devices, our watches, these things that we hope to use in the future are safety, speed, and cost.
Sure.
That's the holy grail. Once we get a battery that has all of those things, then we will truly be in the future.
And the catch is right now we can have 2 out of 3. We can't have 3 out of 3. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Ben Johnson, he's the host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up.
You know, it's no secret the Hollywood Reporter was pretty much, you know, 1 foot in the grave, the other foot, you know, very closely behind it.
It was then, it is not now. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, sometimes called the Blue Chips, rose 56 points today. 0.3%, closed at 17,958. The NASDAQ gained 23 points, about 0.5%, finished at 49.74. The S&P 500 climbed 9 points higher, 0.4%, 2,091 at the bell. General Electric sparked up 2.8% today. There are some reports out there that GE is nearing agreement on a deal to sell a $30 billion real estate portfolio to Blackstone and Wells Fargo. Blackstone chipped up 0.5% today. Wells Fargo raised up more than 0.3%. Alcoa down 3.3% today. The world's third largest producer of aluminum reported worse than expected revenue late yesterday, as in after the bell. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.96%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Treasury Department is scheduled to issue its monthly statement for March. The National Pie Championships get underway in Orlando, Florida. Pie! Everyone be serious. There's a lot of dough at stake. And it helps prevent wardrobe malfunctions and pull-up hemlines. The safety pin was patented April 10, 1849. A shout-out to inventor Walter Hunt. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Selena, the Tejano pop star, was killed just over 20 years ago, but there may be a chance to see her in concert once again. The singer's family is collaborating with a high-tech company to create what it is calling a digital embodiment of Selena that will sing and perform. A cut above, one hopes, the hologram performances we've seen in recent years of singers like Michael Jackson or Tupac Shakur. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at the market for this kind of second act.
Selena Quintanilla was killed when she was only 23, but even by then, she was a huge star. Selena's family is now working with a tech firm called Acrovert to put her back on stage and performing in a project called Selena the One. Abelardo Rodriguez is a spokesman for the project. He says you won't just see a past performance of Selena in hologram form.
It's not limited to that specific song or, you know, a specific clip. This will be open to a lot more possibility.
Rodriguez was vague on the details, but the LinkedIn profile of the chief executive of Acrovert prophesies new Selena songs and videos and the concert tour, perhaps in 2018. Media expert Aram Sinreich is not surprised by the concert plans. He says the music industry used to be built around recordings, but now recordings are mostly marketing tools for live events.
So if you want to recognize profit from artists who are no longer able to perform, you've got to make them kind of perform in posterity.
Sinreich says there's plenty of demand from consumers to see their beloved performers on stage, even if they're not really there. Brad Rogers is the box office editor of the concert industry magazine and database Pollstar. He says over the past several years, concerts featuring 2D images of Elvis have been wildly popular. Their average gross revenues exceeded $300,000. That made them competitive with concerts by living singers.
If we looked at my entire database overall, I think they would be in the, you know, in the top 25 as average gross.
But the technology for the Selena project will be costlier. The tech firm taking it on is starting a campaign to raise $500,000. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
I went out to Hollywood the other day to do a very Hollywood thing, which was to talk about Hollywood. Specifically, talk to the woman who runs one of the two big Hollywood trade papers. There's Variety, and then there's The Hollywood Reporter, and that one is run by Janice Min. Min is the chief creative officer at The Hollywood Reporter. She also runs a little music magazine you might have heard of called Billboard. She came out here about 5 years ago from New York after running Us Weekly for a while. All right, so anyway, I went out to her office, cooled my heels in the lobby for a bit, picked up the most recent issue of The Hollywood Reporter, flipped through it, which prompted a couple of questions, so I led with those when we started talking. Here you go. So I'll tell you what, I was in the waiting room flipping through a copy of the magazine, which I will say again, just for the record, I am taking home with me. I know it's a freebie. And there's all kinds of stuff in here that I don't know that I would expect to find in a Hollywood magazine, right? There's, oh my God, what if Hillary Clinton flames out?
Right.
There's the heat index, who's up, who's not. Lester Holt apparently is up.
Yes.
When you got here to remake this magazine,
Is this what you had in mind?
It's actually exactly what I had in mind. And if you look at the very first issue we did of The Hollywood Reporter, which came out in November of 2010, it is almost identical in terms of the content and the feel of it and the look of it to this. I was of the mindset at the time when we were doing this that Hollywood was such a strange place in that you had this incredibly visual industry with storytellers. Everyone in the world is fascinated by Hollywood, yet the press that covered Hollywood was nowhere. We wasn't keeping up with that conversation
right there.
At all.
It was nowhere. I mean, it was old and fuddy-duddy-ish, right? Yes. You had old Variety, you had the old Hollywood Reporter, and it was a little dusty.
Yeah, it was a lot dusty. And, you know, it's no secret, the Hollywood Reporter was pretty much, you know, one foot in the grave, the other foot, you know, very closely behind it.
So why did you take this job?
Because good question. I felt like I had an outsider's perspective on this industry here where I could look at it and say, wait, if I were an editor working here, I would be doing this and that. Hmm. And I don't know how to do anything. I don't know how to cook. I don't know how to do so many basic things, but I know how to edit a publication.
You came from New York, Us Weekly, the world of celebrity journalism in a this will sound pejorative. I don't mean it to, but in a baser sense.
Completely. Right? Okay. Absolutely.
Did people look down their noses at you when you got here?
I think people were terrified. They thought, oh my God, this is going to be Us Weekly Part 2. And, you know, there was a moment in time when I did Us Weekly, which was between 2003 and 2009, and where it really changed the culture of Hollywood and celebrity. And, Us Weekly rose alongside reality television. We were the first people to ever put The Bachelor on the cover. Oh, wow. You know, I mean, things that I think now you can fast forward 10 years and say, oh, my God, these are the things that have destroyed society. You know, I remember when I left Us Weekly, they did a going away video for me. And Kim Kardashian, who was sort of a nobody, was just becoming a somebody. They got her to say on the video, like, something funny, like, thanks for making my, can I say this word? Thanks for making my, you know, ASS, you know, a star. Like,
and I would point out, just because I was flipping through it in the waiting room, there is a piece in this magazine.
It all comes full circle.
Here it is. How Butts Stole the Spotlight from Boobs.
Yep.
Here we are in Janice Min's News to Hollywood Reporter.
Yeah. But, you know, listen, that I love that story. Merle Ginsburg, our style writer, did that story. And, you know, I had asked her to do it because the fact in there that in 2004, the most searched Google terms about one's butt was how to make it smaller. And in 2014, it's how to make it bigger. It's the fastest growing plastic surgery. What crazy people are doing.
Wait, to make your butt bigger is the fastest growing plastic surgery now?
Yes, fastest growing plastic surgery. And then it's changed the nature of the red carpet, what people wear, how they pose. And we can all thank Kim Kardashian and maybe somewhere way back Us Weekly. You're welcome.
That's right. On behalf of society, thank you. With full acknowledgement that your bosses will eventually hear or read a transcript of this interview, it's been 5 years.
Yeah.
You've turned it around. You're having great success. Now what?
Well, so this is, I will use the biggest cliche that is used in media now.
Go ahead, and then I'll press you on it, but go ahead.
We would like our content to live on all platforms. Have you heard that before?
Yeah, just a couple of times.
So, listen, I think our digital success has been, we just got our February Comscore numbers, which we sort of live and die by on our Comscore numbers, and we are now, it was our biggest month ever for The Hollywood Reporter, our biggest month ever for Billboard. I'll be curious to see where this all goes. I know the conversation in media is, you know, it's just pennies on the dollar, though, compared to what you used to get. So where does it all go? And that's a conversation we have actively all the time here. We have, we have video that we do. We have roundtables that air on television. We actually had a conversation here the other day. Why don't we have podcasts? Do we have a podcast strategy? No, we don't. Let's have a podcast strategy. I mean, some of it is just Wild West stuff.
Sounds a little bit like you're building an empire.
I don't know if I'm building an empire, but I think that what we do is what we do with The Hollywood Reporter and Billboard is something special in that we have access to these worlds and credibility in these worlds that are very, very hard to penetrate.
How much is your success here at The Hollywood Reporter, digital and print, tied to the success of Hollywood? Does Hollywood have to have a good year for you to be having a good year?
No, because Hollywood has had, you know, very not good years, including recently. Last year, box office was down, TV ratings are down, even though overall television audience is up, is just spread out everywhere, probably on too many channels. But One of the other interesting things I observed when I got here was that the story of Hollywood internally was so negative. It was a sport to talk about who was screwing up, who was about to lose his or her job. Hmm. But there was also a great story to tell out of Hollywood. I noticed this right away in New York. The Wall Street factor in New York, you have a whole community of people whose one goal in life is to make money. In Hollywood, you have a whole group of people whose goal in life is to make money, but along the way, they'd like to be critically acclaimed. They'd like to be be thought of as smart people, intelligent people, funny. They want to create something that they're proud of and on their way to making that money. Nobody here deliberately puts out a bad movie. Like, everyone actually believes in it. And I think the level of work you put into a movie or television show, and you have basically one day where it's decided if you failed or succeeded, whether it's at the box office or in television ratings, it's almost heartbreaking. And you sort of understand why people sometimes behave the way they do here, because there's so much on the line with every project that you put out there.
Jenna Smith, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming by.
This final note on the way out today, kind of a biggie, actually, in the social media professional networking space. LinkedIn said this morning it's going to spend $1.5 billion to buy Lynda.com. That's a company that specializes in online professional training videos and tutorials. The bet LinkedIn is making, of course, is that people would now go to LinkedIn for something other than just random clicking around looking for a new job, which is what you guys do too, right? Right? I am not looking for a new job, by the way. Not looking for a new job. And my LinkedIn profile is terrible, so don't look at it. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 56 points today. It's about 0.3%. The NASDAQ gained 23 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 climbed 9 points, 0.4%. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.